maybe before the teams were able to be formed by others' idea. It sounds pretty cool, you know? Let's put a team against it. I think a lot of studios used to start projects that way. That kind of like simple way of starting games might have worked in the past. It's probably not going to work anymore. That is why I think for our team, we spent a lot of time and research before we even decided what genre of game that we are going to tackle.
Hi, I am Sophie Vu, and this is the Rise and Play podcast. In the show, I sit down with influential thought leaders in the gaming industry to deconstruct how they create the best teams and company cultures in order to create the best games. Speaking to hundreds of game executives in the show, I have identified recurring patterns and mistakes that we all make in our leadership journey. Do you have to go through the same hurdles and make the same mistakes to learn too? You are not alone in this journey, and hopefully you can learn from a diverse range of seasoned leaders who already walked the talk. Every episode brings actionable insights and case studies that will help you improve your management skills, self-awareness, and empathic communication. Becoming a better leader starts with becoming a better human. Are you ready to unlock your full potential in life and business? Let's begin. Welcome everyone to a new episode of Rise and Play. And today I am super thrilled to have Charmy Kim with me. I'll give a quick intro why I'm so excited to talk to her today on the podcast. So Charmy is among the, I would say, the rare female game designer we have in the industry with such a long and successful, you know, track record and background. And you turned into the game lead at Space Ape. And during your tenure, you recently launched, during that time, being the game lead on the game, BeatStar. And we'll talk quickly about it. And after leading the development for about 5 years, and also in the meantime, having two babies along the way, I should ask about that. You've now embarked on a new project that is much less musical and much more casual. Maybe we'll talk a bit about that. Super relevant to talk about Space Ape, no, for the latest hit, Chrome Valley, but also BeatStar, big hit 2021, 2022 and beyond, that grossed over 125 million and has attracted over 60 million players since its launch in September 2021. So really impressive, especially for a musical game where many have tried on the ad revenue space and haven't grown that big. So it was really a hit in the space. But I spoke enough and I wanted to welcome you, Charmy, on the podcast. Thank you.
Hi, Sophie. Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, thank you as well. So let's begin with a spark. And I like to start the conversation of, you know, what excites us in our life. And I was wondering, not necessarily for today, but in that phase of life right now for you, what is the most exciting thing?
Most exciting thing I can honestly say is the new project I'm working on right now. We kicked off a new team end of last year, around November time. So we're very fresh and we're kind of in some of my favorite phases of production, in the concepting and the pre-production phase. And then life is just crazy all the time. Life with two kids and work is a crazy thing to juggle. Just a lot of things happening at all times, but I would call that out as my most exciting project.
Yeah, and it must be because, well, it's very exciting to grow a big game such as BeatStar, and quite demanding, I know, having worked on the live games. There is also that moment where you start over again with uncertainty of, will this turn into a hit? Will it scale? Will my creative baby, I call it creative baby, will yeah, see the light of the day or get killed as a project along the way? So it must be really exciting after that long phase. For me, it's important to mention, especially for women growing in our career, where the place of motherhood rarely appears in conversation, but it is a big part of our lives and not one that you can cut. So I was just curious to ask, how old are your two kids now?
Yeah. So my eldest one is 6, or about to be. We have his birthday party this weekend.
Nice.
And then the younger one is 2. Yeah.
Wow, very sweet. So that's also, again, for me, quite impressive when you can keep pursuing your career, your passion, while being a mother. I don't think we say it enough, but it's hard from the other women, CEOs, executives, you know, anyone in games at the senior level. I think it's hard to juggle the two and just acknowledging it.
Yeah, definitely. And I do not feel that the childcare systems or school systems are really shaped to support working mothers. So it comes down to the company or studio and like the partnership that you have to have that support. And I'm very lucky that I do have that. But I think it's worth calling out that it's not often that you get that.
Yeah, highlighting even more the importance of when it's not indeed the state, it's the other parts of the system that can help you and support. So also worth mentioning those parts because they have been important in your life. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do what you do today.
That's exactly it.
So before we get into the exciting journey of BitStar and also what you are maybe doing now, I wanted to track back also your career in games and how you started, which craft you started from, and what led you to join Space Ape.
Yeah, so it's probably very common for a lot of people that got into games around when I did, but a lot of us did not grow up thinking that there was a career in games. There weren't really game-focused programs in universities and things like that, really. But I just came at it kind of by accident. I think in university, for the longest time in high school, I just wanted to be a fashion designer. That's what I thought I wanted to do. I think I always knew I was creative and I wanted to create, but I thought that was fashion. And it's only at the last minute when I was applying for fashion design at Ryerson University, which is now called something else. At the last minute, I thought, you know what? I just don't think I'll be happy making clothes for the rest of my life. I think I want something more. So then I applied for a program called New Media Program, which was the first year they ran a program like that. They didn't really understand what it was really about, but it became just like a free for all where anything that touched a computer and could be called art, you could play around with. So I was playing around with video art, installation art, robotics, Flash, just anything that touched the computer, we were pretty much allowed to do. And I think from there, I really rediscovered my love for games because I did like games, but during high school, I never took it seriously. I wasn't playing a lot of it. But in uni, I really came back to games and just fell in love with it again, maybe a bit too much. And then after that, I worked a little bit as a UI artist. So I have a little bit of an art background. But after that, I thought, you know, I really just want to be in games. So I found a game design program at Vancouver Film School, decided that that was going to be my way in, packed up everything, moved over to Vancouver from Toronto, did my year program there, absolutely loved it, had the best time, met the most amazing people, including my mentor at the time at school was Will Moselle, saw something in me because he was a mentor at the school and gave me my first job as a game designer straight out of school. I owe a lot to him, definitely. Learned a lot from him as well, but that's how I got started, really.
I can relate to that where we probably have started around the same time where, yeah, game was not even a career. And I think education in games probably non-existent. So you're really fortunate to even have a program at that time. It probably also a leap of faith because like it was not really a known career, right? So where would you work after studying that? It's great to hear that you started more out of conviction, that you felt it was something that was really interesting for you. And as you got your first job in game design, where was that? Were you still in Canada or did you relocate, move in Europe?
Yeah, that was at a studio called Big Park in Vancouver that Will had started. That became part of Microsoft because Microsoft purchased Big Park. We went through quite a lot at that studio because at first we were making Facebook games and then Xbox Live games, and then we ended up making Kinect games. So We had quite a few platform changes along the way. After that, for personal reasons, moved to London. After a year in London, moved to product management, and that was through Gree, which had a London studio at the time. Mm-hmm. Went back to Microsoft after Gree at Microsoft Lyft, and then came to Space Ape from there and never left. Been here a really long time.
Yeah, more than 8 years, right? At Space Ape.
Yeah, I think it's 9 now. Yeah.
Wow. So let's track back a bit your career as a designer and PM. And I'm curious, Gree is mobile, right? So game designer and mobile are even more newer because game design is a lot around product management, monetization, progression, especially if it's free to play. So I was curious about your transition for you as a designer on in those companies and to product management, and what have you learned from both sides?
Yeah, so I think when I was doing game design in Vancouver at Big Park, because we were looking at Facebook games and then Xbox Live games, we were looking at free-to-play. That was my first exposure to free-to-play, even as a concept. That was not part of anything that you were taught at school. And I became very quickly fascinated by it. And I think there's a lot to love as a game designer, because as a game designer, you are thinking about, you know, how to create systems that create certain kind of experiences and motivations and behavior. And to me, that extended quite naturally to, oh, well, how do we create motivations that allow them to, you know, spend in the way they want? And something that was also attractive to me for free-to-play is how democratic it felt. Like there were no barriers to entry, if you will. Like all you need is a device. You don't even need a really good device. Mm-hmm. And it allows you to play. And this was very attractive to me from the sense of like wanting to reach a lot of audiences and a lot of audiences that wouldn't typically think of themselves as gamers. Like that was very attractive to me. So I think I became very interested in free-to-play, and mobile became like the hotbed for free-to-play development, really, because that is the native business model to this platform. Whereas in console and PC, it wasn't quite there. And Facebook games had, you know, slowly kind of gone into decline. So I think mobile became like a natural place to look for me. And also product management became a natural transition in a way as well, because I really saw it as a way to extend the design now to kind of business design. And a lot of product managers were doing a lot of design things. Like that is kind of changing again in our industry, because there's just so much to design and there's so much to think about. So it's becoming segmented again. But at the time, a lot of product managers were doing game design and vice versa. That transition made a lot of sense.
Mm. I would like to ask as a follow-up question, because game design is quite broad and you mentioned several parts that are around system, progression, monetization, the business design. I think those two words together, I haven't heard it often, but it kind of makes a lot of sense in free-to-play. So I wanted to understand also, what are your core strengths as a designer? How you really, over time, your career, maybe circumstances, you really specialize that you love doing, I guess, as well. But this is where you can claim that you really understand it deeply and well.
Yeah, good question. I think it's definitely changed over time, and I'm sure that happens with everybody's career. Like if I had to describe now, my strengths are quite different because I am in much more of a leadership position. So I'm giving guidance to the others, and I see my role mostly as an alignment role. I hold the voice of the audience and I hold the voice of the market, and being able to help direct all the other disciplines and aligning them against that purpose. Alignment is a very different skill set. It's much more about people and creating places for discussion, creating places for brainstorming. I'm doing a lot less of like what I think I used to do. I think I'm sure I'm still good at it, but you know, I just haven't done it in a while. I think I intuitively have a good sense for designing systems, but not in a quantitative way, but more in the qualitative way, because I feel that being able to empathize very quickly with the end user has always been my strength. And then like being able to translate that back down to, okay, the system roughly needs to behave like this in order for it to have the motivations like this, you know, kind of like closing that loop between the end experience back to what the design needs to be, roughly. In terms of what I like doing the most, I've always liked information design. I've always liked kind of organizing things in a way that is like easily digested. And I always liked doing that. So I always liked working in diagrams and creating like visual documentation for any sort of design. So
yeah, thanks for sharing. It's also interesting to hear the evolution of it, where I agree it's not only by the industry, but by the seniority, you know, and responsibility. And we'll get back to that, too, especially in terms of leadership. Not the same thing to design the game and to lead the design or the creative vision direction of the game. So I want to here understand the transition point you had as well when you joined Space Ape Games. When was that? What was the anchor point for you, motivation, if any? And what did you start to work on and specialize before you even started BitStar?
Yeah, so I remember super clearly what motivated me to join. And my first interview with Joe Rayburn, who's not there anymore, he's in New Zealand now, but it was like a super intense interview where he like barraged me with questions for like 2.5 hours at a coffee shop. But at the end of it, I think what convinced him and me maybe was like me just really latching on to this sense that this studio had a lot of passion. And that aligned very much with what I wanted to do. And I really felt like the studio had a commitment to that. I still believe that to be true of Space Ape. That's why I can't leave. But yeah, that's just like commitment. I remember John was quoted in saying in articles at the time that we wanted to be the Blizzard of mobile, is what he used to say. I think we still have those passions. We might not say Blizzard anymore necessarily. Maybe we would say Supercell, but you know, that is another good reason why Supercell were interested in us and ended up investing in us, because we had that alignment of a vision of like what kind of games we wanted to deliver.
Yeah, it's great to hear in your words how you describe Space Ape, because I can say also from the perception outside, yes, at the time where Supercell acquired, it was in 2017 for 55.9 million shares at Space Ape. There was really an alignment in the thesis on how to approach teams and creativity and giving a lot of independence for teams. So the past years that have been visible from Space Ape have been definitely very creative. We can even say innovative. Not all of them succeeded, right? But you've tried and you've been very visible with also. I can totally see how motivating, if you're driven by creativity, passion, and creating those new experiences, how at the core, you know, the company, it has translated. So it's interesting because I remember at the time also when I was at Wooga at the time, live ops were actually more of a big thing, and SpaceApp actually transitioned, was probably from 10 years ago to 7-8 years ago, to being more intentional about launching new games, those experiences, and being known for it, like the Blizzard of mobile. What was your experience for that transition? Because I do remember as well, you were working on Big Life Games, and probably that was your transition before you started leading BitStar.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, so when I first joined, I joined Samurai Siege. That was my first project.
Yes.
And I joined as a live ops manager. So very much hands-on. It was such a fun project to work on and fun place to be, because I think around that time, the studio had moved a lot of resources away from Samurai Siege onto Rival Kingdoms and then Transformers. So it became like the smallest team, the scrappiest team, you know, like the eyes were elsewhere. So we did a lot of like crazy things.
Nice. That,
we took a lot of risks, and also the funnest thing about Samurai Siege, which is like terrible at the same time, was it had a crazy content pipeline where pretty much like everything was controlled from like one giant spreadsheet. And you could do crazy things with that spreadsheet. Like you could combine a troop with a different art and like add different behaviors to it, make like little spiders come out of a big spider, you know, like that sort of thing you could do with just a spreadsheet. So from a creativity point of view, we were given a bit too much maybe. But yeah, it became a great learning experience because we were allowed to try new things, see where it was working or was not working, allowed to make mistakes in a way, in a contained way.
Mm-hmm.
And then I moved on to Rival Kingdoms, which was already live by the time I moved on to it. So I was doing product management, but from a live kind of perspective. And I did those things before I moved on to Project Unicorn, which never saw the light of day, but it was a bit of an incubation team experiment, which led me to believe that incubation teams don't really work. That might be spicy, but that is when BeatStar started.
So this is where I'm really curious to ask, from your experience, there's a lens of strategy here where, you know, there's the argument we can say where a company, you become better at what you master, right? So let's say you have, like, at the time of LiveOps, a clear focus on a certain type of game, strategy game, the Samurai Siege and Rival Kingdom. That's how I perceive Space Ape. They are good at doing those games, running the LiveOps and the Transformers, and they will keep doing that. And then suddenly you have a series of games. I saw some attempts in puzzle, musical games, and now so we have a Chrome Valley. So I was curious, how was that transition in terms of almost like a reset of company? Because exploring a new genre, it is a stretch where you are not building on top of your strength and you may have to learn from zero where others have started before, right? There have been other music game companies and you start on a new genre.
Yeah, I can think back to where we explicitly made that choice, I think, where we said, you know what, we're not going to be happy with just becoming really good at live opsing genres that are already maybe very, very known. Because up until that point, we had only made, we call them build and battle, the Clash of Clans type games.
Yeah.
And there was an explicit point that John decided, you know what, that is not going to be what is going to define our studio. Like, John himself has a lot of desire to be creative. He is a creative at heart. And so that was a point where I think we left like 20% of the studio on live games, shifted everybody else to what we call top of the funnel. At one point, I think we had 11 games in the top of the funnel.
Yes.
That was how insane it was. I think there were some teams that were just two or three people. Some teams were a little bit bigger. It was a wild and fun time. You can imagine when there's like 11 different like creative projects going on. Like,
yeah.
That sense of creativity, I don't think I'll ever experience again. It did feel quite naive. Like, when I think back to where we were at the time, it is as if like we were a child again. You know, we were all like children playing again. Since then, I feel that we really did mature quite a lot. And so this like new project that I'm starting, we are still trying to innovate, but we're trying to innovate in a more serious way. And I think it also reflects where the mobile platform really has come as well. I think the mobile platform in the early stages, anything goes, you know, people were free to create. It was a new platform. Everybody was doing something new. So it was like very free. And then in the heyday of hyper casual, it felt like that as well. It's like there's this like business innovation that happened via hyper casual. And there was like an explosion of mechanics, like any mechanic goes, you know. Our studio, as well as the entire platform, is getting to a more mature phase where our audience, they're not going to be new to mobile games. They have played something before, you know, whether it's Clash of Clans or something else. Like, they have already played these games more likely than ever. And this was even true of BeatStar. When we launched BeatStar, we thought our like drive for BeatStar was a little bit naive in that like we wanted to introduce, you know, music games to people that never played music games before. And they just had to be music fans and then they'll fall in love with playing games on their mobile, you know, but it wasn't really true. What we found in the end is actually most of our audience is a music mobile gamer audience. And chances are they've played Piano Tiles. Chances are they played Magic Tiles, you know. Where BeatStar started was in a very naive place. Where BeatStar launched and ended up is in a very mature place. And those are the learnings that I'm trying to take away as we kick off the new project.
That's super interesting. Several, I would say, more case studies I see also with the journey of Space Ape as a company. When you put 20% of your, you know, teams on live games, basically cash flow, revenues, and 80%, it's a big move, big risk-taking for innovation. Usually it's the other way if you follow like business strategy. So it was a big bet at the time. It paid off like 7-8 years later. But all I'm saying is it was a big bet at that time and exploring other genres. And you started with a thesis of grabbing audience that were not necessarily players, but from the theme of music. And the number of people who have a mobile and haven't played at least a game is almost nil, especially with hyper casual, right? So understanding that as you've learned through the journey, and this is where I find so fascinating the case of BitStar, because there's definitely has been a journey of iteration, right? It's not like we started like this and we stayed this way. I was curious about the key learnings at BitStar as you grew, because at the time you had exactly, as you said, the piano tiles over music games. And as you were competing in the space against other than suddenly mobile music players, what were the intentional choice of design you did to say, okay, we're going to differentiate ourselves in the space with this XYZ?
Yeah, I think the most obvious choice that we made from the get-go was we wanted to use recordings of the artists as well as just the songs, which is a big point of difference, not necessarily from a design perspective, but more from a marketing and business perspective, because a lot of the other games like Magic Tiles, a lot of their songs only do one sort of licensing, which is the publishing licensing. So they only need to pay for the use of the songs and not the recordings. They re-record most of their music with their own artists. And we didn't want to do that. And that was like from the onset, maybe coming from a slight place of naivety, but we wanted to make sure the artists were just as well represented in our game. We're music lovers. We wanted the app to be the most beautiful showcase of their music as possible, which enabled some things became difficult for other things. As anything, there's pros and cons. The other ways that we differentiated was because we wanted to be a IAP-driven game. That was the world we knew. We wanted a game with more longevity, stronger, longer-term retention, things like that. We knew we had to kind of create core loops where there weren't really ones that we could reference, because the hyper-casual models that the Tiles games follow don't really require that. So we did a lot of design iterations on, you know, how to keep players in the game, how to like chunk out the music into creating a longer term experience. Seems simple. It was not simple. It was like incredibly difficult, but that was a point of innovation. And then thirdly, we also wanted something different out of the gameplay. It's very subtle, but in the Tiles games, there are four lanes. It gets a bit technical, but because of the visual way that they represent tiles, they are not able to map very closely to the rhythm of certain songs. If the rhythm is very fast and irregular, it becomes very difficult for them. Whereas we wanted to have more of the feel that we were used to having grown up playing Guitar Hero, these kind of music games. We wanted to be able to map closer to that rhythm. So two things in BeatStar are, there are only three lanes. What happens when you have three instead of four lanes is that you have to do some thinking when it comes to the middle lane. Mm. Because in four lanes, you have one finger to do the two left ones and one finger to do the two right ones, and you don't have to think. In BeatStar, the middle lane is the one where you're like, oh, I have to decide if I want to use my left thumb or right thumb right now. And that to me was very important, because as a music gamer, that is a little bit where the fun is in terms of like deciding how to use your fingers. The other thing we did was we broke away from the tiles format of having kind of continuous tiles so that we could do smaller taps, smaller rhythmic taps. It allowed us to then map more closely when it came to metal songs or songs with a lot of guitar, which then led us to be able to recreate the feeling of playing those songs better. There is hidden innovation in there.
Mm.
Definitely.
It's super interesting because, well, you say it's a subtle change. It's a big game changer in the depth of the experience, right? And this is where it's fascinating because it's not like the grand also changes, but it's in how the UX, I would call it pure UX and how you play. I played BeatStar quite a lot at the beginning and I just couldn't put my finger on. But it felt really fun to play mechanically, right? But I thought it was, okay, there's something with the UX, the timing, I don't know. And I just didn't think at all about the lanes because I didn't, analyze side by side. But now you say it, it's the feeling, the way I felt playing it was very engaging, very musical. It's like I was dancing with my fingers. So it's really interesting to hear the intention and how it was delivered as an experience. And that has played a part with a long-term retention and design, which is, again, if you think from a differentiator, a positioning, many music games were more positioned as hyper-casual and maybe that some didn't have a knowledge on how to build a long, long-term progression. So you had definitely that expertise to utilize and back to what Space Ape has, to bring to games. And then the really innovation, the core changes in the gameplay, in the way of playing, and then the partnership, like the way you onboard the artist and the quality of the music, which is part of the experience, but also how you sign the deals, right? So it's really interesting. And then if the result speaks for itself, the game is still big. I have a former colleague from my studio at Vodou, Marianne, Koti Marianne. But yeah, she's been enjoying a lot working in the team and big team. It's really impressive, design and iteration. I would give credit to that for the success of BeatStar. Okay, and with all of that, as you move to a new project, I think here I wanted to zoom out a little bit on your view as a product manager, business designer, however you call it, or game leader, things that you really took with you the past 10, 15 years in games, in mobile, on starting a brand new game. It's really hard these days. I'm just thinking, how would a team in a studio start?
It's very simple, but I think it's very powerful. And that is the word research.
Mm-hmm.
Research in many, many different ways. You could do research by just looking at the market and what is doing well, what is not doing well via tools like Sensor Tower and Appani and things. It's not called Appani anymore, though, is it?
Data,
yeah. There's that way of doing research. There's so many tools now for reaching out directly to players, having an interest in players that are playing the kind of game that you think they would be playing, Even if you think you're coming out with a new genre entirely, the player is probably not coming up what's coming from anywhere new, That player that you are seeking is currently playing something else. So even if it is the player of that something else, having a chance to talk to them in person. Playtest Cloud now has so many tools and so many ways you can very, very affordably reach the user that you might benefit from speaking to. There is also ways that you can do kind of early market testing. So many ways of doing that now, either via running a static ad on Facebook or Instagram, seeing what kind of clicks that you might get. There are ways to do that research through tools where you can make fake app stores and measure data that way. And I say all of this because I'm sure people are saying this all the time, but marketing a game is where the real risk is not even about anymore necessarily. Are you going to be able to monetize them? Even retention, I think, is not as hard as being able to reach them in the first place or being able to be a game that excites them in the first place. So as much research you can do on what the market looks like, I think is helpful when you're starting a project and it's not to be ignored. And this is where I think it's also changed the way we form teams, because maybe before the teams were able to be formed by there's an idea. It sounds pretty cool, Let's put a team against it. I think a lot of studios used to start projects that way. Or maybe, oh, you know what games do well these days is merge. Everybody make merge, you know. That kind of like simple way of starting games might have worked in the past. It's probably not going to work anymore. And if you read carefully through Ilka's big, big blog post, he'll also say that we're now forming teams first and foremost. And then for our team, we spent a lot of time in research before we even decided what genre of game that we are going to tackle. So the investment needs to be a little bit front loaded. Luckily, we have the ability to do that. Sometimes it takes quite a bit of time. Not everybody is able to afford to do that, but as much as you can.
Very important lessons. And what I take away from this is, well, market first, which is the main challenge, not just mobile, but period. And so we reach really a distribution ceiling and cap. And it's not about grabbing new audiences, but more, you know, how do you grab attention more actually away from, it's not existing games, but just life, you know, entertainment. And second is the way building teams are take away is really the versatility. Because again, you could say, oh, I need to be excited to work on a game and I will work on that game. And is that model still viable where you just form a team based on affinity and passion? Of course, you need to find interest. But how business realistic that is these days where it's, you know, market first and then the team adapts to the demand rather than we have an idea of what we want to do and see who would like to play it, right? So the other way around now.
That is so true. And that is a particularly interesting challenge that maybe Space A is a bit better prepared for because we've done such a crazy diverse, different number of things. I think one of our devs on my current team, I think he's built every single genre of game at some point in the 8 years he's been with us. So whenever he's been asked to build anything new, like nothing scares him, you know, because he's built everything once before. Yeah, you're right. I think that being able to be flexible and adaptable is more key than ever.
Well, that was a lot. We went through 8 years and 15 years of your life through Space Ape and your life. Thanks a lot for all the learnings and sharing a lot of very good lessons, I would say, of career in game design, but also company journey, especially the case of Space Ape, which is really, again, a good case study for the industry and what it takes to survive in the industry over ages. So thanks a lot for sharing all of it. And I wish you a great day. And I look forward to your future project.
Oh, thank you.
Take care, Charmy.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this latest episode of the Rise and Play podcast. I am growing a community of conscious leaders across the industry and beyond. If you want to join this movement, please share the podcast with other conscious leaders because we have so much more we can learn from each other. If you've enjoyed this episode, please follow and rate the show on Spotify or your other favorite podcast platform. It will help other growing leaders to discover the show and benefit from the valuable insights. If you would like to grow rapidly your leadership skills, you can find more insights on riseandplay.io, where you will also find my free masterclass on conscious leadership and other resources that I offer. Have a great week, and remember to take care of yourself. Until the next time,